MechCast, Tuesday, May 7th, 2019. Hey, Mech Geeks, it's time for your MechCast, the show for Mech Geeks by Mech Geeks. I'm Adam, and this is the show where we discuss all things Macintosh. How you doing? Welcome back to the MechCast. Well, it's looking like a little bit of a light news week this week, although that doesn't mean we don't have some pretty good things to talk about. Of course, things are happening in the world of Apple and Macintosh, and we're going to get into some of those in this week's episode, including some follow-up to something we talked about on last week's episode with the screen time apps being pulled, or screen time and parental control apps being pulled from the App Store. A little bit of development there. We're going to talk about some sales numbers for Apple Watch. How is it doing in the marketplace? I bet you can probably guess. Also, we're going to talk about Apple's most historic retail location, some possible new designs for the next generation iPhone, and also Apple making some acquisitions and actually talking about it, something that is a little bit rare. So that'll round out the news for this week. And then we're going to get into a lot of great feedback from you from the previous episodes, talking about all kinds of things, Apple Watch and water resistance. We're going to talk about the Apple plug recall that was happening in the UK, those international plugs that we told you about on the last episode of the MacCast. I have some feedback on the cracker bump that might be showing up on the next generation iPhone, and a little bit regarding the terminology I've been using for that. And then a conversation about too many app updates on our iOS devices. And finally, we'll wrap things up with another listener thing of the moment. I often give you things of the moment, but we've had a couple of listeners write in with some of their favorite stuff. And so hopefully we'll be getting more of those, but I have one of those for you in this week's episode. And that will round everything out. So before we get into everything, I do want to take a quick moment and thank one of my show sponsors, and that is Malwarebytes. You know what? Malware, it's definitely a thing, and unfortunately it is a thing even on our Macs. Adware, spyware, viruses, you know, we try to stay diligent. We try and keep on top of it. Apple does a great job of having our backs, but unfortunately, it is not always enough. You know, even if you're able to say stay safe with your Macintosh, maybe a friend or a family member isn't so lucky. They might not be as tech savvy or aware. They get hit by this stuff. And as much as we try to protect them from themselves, things can happen. And you've probably heard me talk about Malwarebytes on the show in the past, and that's because I really do think it's one of the best and easiest tools you can use on the Mac to quickly scan and remove and prevent malware. One thing I really like about it is it kind of fits how you want to work. You can scan and use it just as you need it, or you can actually let it actively or proactively keep your Mac safe. It's all really up to you. And plus, it uses proven technology that absolutely crushes the growing threat of Mac malware. And it really does. They stay on top of that stuff. Malwarebytes is also fast. On the average Mac, it scans in under 30 seconds and can remove adware and unwanted programs, things that can actually slow down your Mac. It's great for kind of clearing up some of those beach balls and things you might run across, especially if you've been hit by a piece of malware, adware, spyware, that sort of thing. And if you need more active protection, it does detect and remove viruses, ransomware, and other malware in real time with advanced malware technology. It catches dangerous threats automatically, so you're protected without actually even having to think about it. Finally, cybersecurity smart enough for the Mac. Visit malwarebytes.com/Mac for your free download and a 14-day trial of their premium offering. That's malwarebytes.com/Mac. And a big thank you to Malwarebytes for their support of the show. Last week, we mentioned how Apple had started removing several third-party screen time monitoring and parental control apps from the App Store. The issue, if you remember, was that these apps were using multi-device management technology which was a violation of Apple's store guidelines. And they had kind of given these developers about 30 days to adjust their software and said, hey, if you don't, we're going to actually remove these programs from the store. And part of the issue Apple has with this is a little bit of timing, because they started removing these apps not long after they came out with their own screen time solution in iOS. And Apple says, hey, we're not removing them because we have our own tool. What's actually going on is that multi-device management software, that's designed for system administrators, enterprise environments, people who manage and maintain multiple devices, large government deployments, large enterprise deployments, and the techniques that are used in multi-device management basically give the server software almost unfettered access to the device, which is a huge security and privacy concern, especially in a consumer setting. So if you're buying into a third-party app that's using this technology, basically that third-party app has really almost root-level access to your device, and that's a concern on, you know, from Apple's point of view, also should be a concern from the consumer's point of view, right? They can potentially do bad things. Now, there's no evidence that these companies were doing that, but Apple wanted to shut that down. So that's what they went ahead and did. The trouble, of course, was that multi-device management is about the only way a third-party app can get to specific functions or functionality that you might want in a screen time monitoring or parental control app on iOS. So this was kind of the workaround, the compromise that these companies were using. And if they want to be able to function similarly to what Apple is offering in screen time with the screen time app, or even with the built-in parental controls, this was how they had to do it. So Apple shut that down, and that caused, as you might imagine, quite an outcry from the developer community. Several of the ousted developers behind a lot of these parental control apps have issued open letters to Apple in the following week, trying to ask Apple to create an API and open up the screen time and parental control features to third-party apps so that they can actually re-put these apps on the App Store and compete with Apple. And I think that is a proper thing to do, to make that call to say, hey, if we can't do it the way we were doing it, we would like an Apple-blessed or an Apple-approved way of doing it. And I think actually it was something that Apple either was or is already planning on doing. And I frankly wouldn't be surprised if they showed off an API for this, or at least parts of an API for this, at Worldwide Developer Conference coming up in June. I think they are planning on having an API for screen time and parental control features. And I somewhat feel like screen time might be a kind of open beta or an Apple beta of them figuring out some of these tools and these APIs and things like that. Apple actually doing some real-world testing, basically eating their own dog food and seeing if this stuff will work. And as Apple often does, they'll come out with a feature, then open up an API, and then what's great is you get third-party developers coming in and really pushing the technology forward, taking it beyond what Apple is even doing with their own software. And that's how they differentiate between the built-in stuff and the stuff that maybe you want to pay a third-party app developer for. So I really like this idea. I absolutely personally love screen time and the parental controls that are built into iOS currently. I use them, but I certainly would welcome other options. And I think consumers really enjoy having the choice as well. And I think ultimately Apple gets it. You know, I think when these things go down, when this stuff happens, because Apple is often secretive, they don't really talk openly about this stuff. You get a lot of people sort of with, I don't want to say hurt feelings, but not really understanding maybe what's going on or not getting the full picture and drawing conclusions. And I think rightful conclusions, thinking that, oh, this really looks like Apple just trying to shut this stuff down. But I think very rarely that is actually what Apple is trying to do. I think they're trying to create that balance between security and privacy of their devices and their consumers' data, along with features and functionality for their developers. And I think ultimately they'll get there. I think this will open up and we will see an API. I hope it'll happen at this Worldwide Developer Conference, but it may be another year or two before we actually see it. And only time will tell. We're going to have to wait and see what they do and what they talk about at WWDC. But I think certainly these developers are within their rights to write some open letters and to make a call for this kind of functionality. I see absolutely nothing wrong with that. Apple Watch is still the king of smartwatches, at least when it comes to popularity. This is according to Counterpoint Research. For the first 3 months of 2019, Apple Watch remained the world's most popular smartwatch. They estimate that the Apple Watch had an almost 36% market share. That significantly beats out the next nearest manufacturer, which was Samsung. According to Counterpoint, they had about 11% share of the world's smartwatch market. Counterpoint also estimated that Apple Watch shipments had increased 49% year over year, and that the big feature that consumers are after, specifically with the Apple Watch 4, and the one that they're really interested in, is the ECG feature. So the heart rate monitoring feature is kind of the one that's drawing people to purchase new Apple Watches and led to that 49% year over year increase. I think it also helps that Apple has recently expanded the ECG feature into 19 European countries and Hong Kong, moving it outside of just the US where it originally launched. I think they have big plans to roll it out even further this year, so hopefully more and more people will get that feature, and that should also help just continue to boost Apple Watch sales. I know it's not hard evidence of Apple Watch popularity, but I have to say, I see more and more Apple Watches these days when I'm out and about, and I think I've heard from many of you who tell me exactly the same thing, that when you notice people actually wearing watches, very often it will be an Apple Watch versus even, say, like a Fitbit or even a fitness band. I'm seeing them more and more, and I don't know if that's due to the multiple price points, some of these new features like the health features. I think it does help, too, when you hear about Apple Watch actually saving lives. We've had several of these stories where either the heart rate monitoring feature, the ECG feature, the new fall detection features and things like that, they're actually helping people and making an impact, a positive impact in people's lives and saving people's lives, which is just absolutely amazing. So I think all that good positivity, along with the health and fitness features, which are also very popular with the Apple Watch, they motivate people to get out there, exercise more, move more, breathe better, just have overall better health. And I know it has worked for me. Surprisingly, I didn't think it would make as much of an impact as it does, but it got me moving and I need to get back to it. I've kind of fallen behind, but certainly my Apple Watch does remind me, hey, you're not moving as much, so get moving. And I think that's all a really good thing. And I think people are responding to that. And I think many of us are sharing those experiences with friends and family, and that interests them in buying Apple Watch too. So I think that's being reflected in these sales numbers. So overall, good news for Apple and Apple Watch. Apple is getting set to open their most historic retail location so far. They are planning to open a new retail store in Washington, D.C. on May 11th. Tim Cook told the Washington Post that Apple Carnegie Library is Apple's, quote, most historic, ambitious restoration so far in the world. Apple actually began plans to open the store and events center within the Carnegie Library in Mount Vernon Square back in 2016, and they have reportedly since spent about $30 million to complete the project. Coinciding with the launch of the new store, Apple is also kicking off one of their most ambitious Today at Apple programs yet, the Storymakers Festival. It is going to be 6 weeks of sessions featuring over 40 creators at that new retail location. Some other cool things about the building is that it's not going to house just an Apple store. It's also going to have the nonprofit Historical Society of Washington, D.C. in there rent-free, and they will be opening a new D.C. History Center. So it really is going to be another one of Apple's retail stores. It's a flagship store meant to be kind of a gathering place. I think the article in the Washington Post also described the fact that, like, when you walk in, you're not really going to see the retail displays and stuff like that. They're going to be off to the sides and the little niches and stuff like that. So I think it's going to be one of Apple's most unique locations, and I'd be very excited to see it. I've never actually been to Washington, D.C., but if I ever make it there, it certainly will be on my list. I'm sure many of you live in the area, and if you happen to visit the new retail store after May 11th, send us some pictures. Give me your thoughts and comments on it. Even maybe send in an audio comment. Let us know what you think about it. And is it really different than maybe some of the other Apple retail store locations? Certainly from the exterior, it looks like it. And it looks like Apple has done a beautiful job on the restoration just from the pictures and things like that. So I think it'd be amazing to see in person. It's always fun when Apple opens a new flagship store. I was lucky enough, last year at MacStock to be able to go see the Chicago store, which is absolutely beautiful and amazing right there on the waterfront. And I absolutely loved it. So I got some great pictures and had a great time visiting that one. And I look forward to getting to more Apple retail stores in the future, maybe even some outside of the U.S. I've never been to one outside the U.S. either, so maybe that's in my future. I'd be curious to know, too, if there's any of you in our community who have been to multiple retail stores, and especially multiple retail stores globally, who has the record? Who has the most? Shoot me an email. Let me know how many Apple retail stores you've visited. I think we had one listener who, way back when, was trying to visit every retail location in the U.S. Now, Apple keeps opening new ones, so I don't know if he ever achieved that goal, but I seem to remember he had been to at least one in almost all 50 states. So I don't know if Apple even has one in all 50 states at this point, but I would imagine that they do. Should have checked that before the show. Kind of went off on a tangent there. But I'd be curious to know what retail stores you have visited and how many you've visited. So shoot me some emails and feedback, maccast@gmail.com. You know, it actually is a slow news week when the big iPhone rumor is a new antenna design, but that's what we have for the 2019 iPhone this week. Ming-Chi Kuo has looked at the supply chain and says there are, quote, vast changes in antenna structures. Ooh, are you excited about antennas? Gives me shivers. No, it really doesn't. But hey, it's new iPhone technology, right? And this is the MacCast, so let's talk about it. The changes, he says, are in the suppliers and the technology. So Apple trying to open up the number of suppliers available, and they're going to do that by mixing up the technology a little bit, maybe bringing some of their costs down a little bit as well. He says the 2019 iPhones will use a combination of the current liquid crystal polymer antenna technology with a new modified PI antenna structure. Currently, the models of iPhone that Apple sells use only LCP technology, both in the two upper antenna and two lower antenna inside the iPhone. According to Ming-Chi Kuo, the 2019 iPhones are said to use a single MPI and LCP unit for the upper antenna, and that they will use three MPI assemblies in the lower antenna. And the benefits for Apple in using that tech are that, one, there are more antenna suppliers available to Apple, so Apple will be able to negotiate better rates for antennas, and also the antenna technology, at least for 4G LTE, offers the same performance as LCP, which they've been using, and is a little bit more costly to produce and has fewer suppliers. So Apple gains some benefits, at least for this year's iPhones, considering they're not going to 5G technologies. But Ming-Chi Kuo also does predict that in 2020, Apple will shift back to LCP because it does have better performance for 5G, and we are expecting Apple to introduce 5G in 2020 when the technology is more widely available and rolled out, which is historically what Apple does with any new cellular technology. They usually don't jump on board right in the first year. They wait for wider deployment and adoption and then roll out phones after that, much to the chagrin of some more tech-savvy or bleeding edge customers. But ultimately, I think it really is the right thing to do, because even those specs and standards can kind of change and tweak a little bit all the way through rollouts. I don't know if that's the case with 5G, but I remember 4G kind of being a little bit in flux, and it got better and better over the years. So that's probably what Apple's going to do, and it's looking like in 2019 they will have a slightly modified, different antenna technology in those iPhones. Yeah, I know it's not super exciting, but hey, we got to go with the news that we have. And finally in the news for this week, Apple has been buying up companies at maybe even a faster rate than usual. And not only that, they're talking about it a little bit. Tim Cook was at the Berkshire Hathaway annual shareholders meeting, and he sat down for an interview with CNBC. In that interview, he revealed that Apple has bought 25 companies in the past 6 months. That is actually a pretty quick clip. It averages more than one company every 2 to 3 weeks. And Apple does from time to time, you know, buy and purchase other companies. They usually don't comment on them. So even Tim Cook just mentioning this in an interview is a little bit rare. And even for Apple, this pace seems a little bit more frantic and quicker than usual. They didn't really comment on what companies they had bought, but Tim Cook did offer some other insights into how Apple decides which companies to acquire. He says that Apple acquires everything that they need that can fit and has a strategic purpose to it, and that they are usually eyeing, quote, talent and intellectual property. So trying to pull in technologies and talent, rather, that would be a really good fit inside Apple. And I don't think that really reveals a whole lot other than, wow, that makes a lot of sense. And that seems to be what Apple does. But it does kind of give you this hint that if you keep a pretty close eye on the kinds of companies that Apple is acquiring, you might be able to infer or get an idea of what direction they're moving in terms of future products. And we've seen that happen before, right? We've known, for example, that they've been hiring a lot of modem chip designers and modem technology folks over the past few years, and that's led us to believe that they're probably working on designs for their own cellular modem chips, right? Or they're hiring a lot of electrical, you know, a lot of car engineers, both in terms of autonomous vehicles, autonomous systems, artificial intelligence, all those sorts of things, also battery technologies and whatnot. Hey, they might actually be working on an electric vehicle or an autonomous car or something related to those sorts of technologies. And so it is a great way to kind of figure out what Apple is up to. But they often do just buy companies that seem a little bit out there too, like we've seen some of those. So it doesn't always work, but interesting nonetheless that Apple seems to be ramping up the purchases. And I have a feeling that might have something to do with them looking for what the next big thing is going to be and trying to invest in that as well. Also, probably some of those acquisitions having to do with their ramping up of their services as well. But that will kind of do it for the news for this week. Before we move on, I do want to take a second and thank another show sponsor, and that is Linode, a new sponsor here on the MacCast. Glad to have them on board with us. Linode allows you to instantly deploy and manage an SSD server in the Linode cloud. You can get a server running in seconds with your choice of Linux distribution, resources, and a choice of up to 10 node locations. And right now, they are giving all new MacCast customers a $20 credit. You know, I've been wanting to set up a Minecraft server. Yep, I play Minecraft on my Mac and I absolutely love it. I've been wanting to do that for a while, and I was excited because Linode actually offers one-click installs for gaming platforms. They have Minecraft, Ark, Terraria, and a whole bunch more. They also have one-click installs for things like WordPress, Drupal, GitLab, OpenVPN, and a bunch of other stuff. So if you want to run a VPN server, there's a great option there at Linode. They also offer a whole bunch of Linux distributions. Basically, if it runs on Linux, it runs on Linode. Most distributions are available right out of the box, but you can even upload custom images and create your own. Basically, you can build whatever server you want on Linode. They feature native SSD storage, a 40 gigabit network, and have industry-leading processors. that you can pick from any of their 10 worldwide data center locations. And as a matter of fact, they just opened a new center, their newest one in Toronto, Canada. They built it using their most up-to-date hardware and their next-generation network backbone, and it allows users to comply with in-country data protection requirements while taking advantage of all of Linode's technologies and tools. They have also an additional data center opening up in Mumbai, India, by the end of 2019. Another cool thing about Linode is that their pricing is simple, no surprise fees. You pay for what you use with hourly billing across all of their plans, and they have add-on services that you can get for additional features. You can get what you need from about $5 a month for a Nanode plan, all the way up to high-powered dedicated CPU plans. Their dashboard actually makes it really easy to manage your Linodes, and upgrading your plan is also super simple. And like I said, you can add on things like backups, large storage volumes, and load balancing. So you can really kind of customize it for what you need. And finally, you can get the support you need with their 24/7 live customer support. And they also have a large documentation library, which provides a great resource for when you might get stuck, you know, setting up and configuring your server. So visit linode.com/maccast to set up your first Linode and get a $20 credit when you use the promo code MACCAST2019. That's linode.com, linode.com/maccast, and be sure to use the code MACCAST2019 to get a $20 credit on your new Linode account. And a big thank you to Linode for their support of the MACCAST. You may remember last week we had a listener who wrote in, might have even been an audio comment. I think it was an audio comment, and he commented on the Apple Watch and its water resistance rating. He had an Apple Watch, he had gone on vacation, he had showered with his Apple Watch, he was swimming with his Apple Watch, he was in the ocean, in the pool, all those sorts of things, and ultimately he had the speaker go out on his Apple Watch, and he was just giving his experience in getting a repair and replacement. It wasn't so positive, and I made some comments about the Apple Watch and just its water resistance rating in general, just so that people understood sort of where Apple stood on it. The Apple Watch is water resistant. It's not waterproof, and there's certain scenarios which Apple notes kind of in its legal copy that are frowned upon in terms of how you might use your Apple Watch when it comes to water sports and water activities and stuff like that. And Ali wrote in to point out that I had commented on Apple's recommendation that you not take the Apple Watch below depths of 50 meters and that you don't do scuba diving with it. And I think I may have confused the issue a little bit when I read the actual legal copy from Apple's website, which said, quote, Apple Watch Series 4 has a water resistance rating of 50 meters under ISO standard 22810. :2010. This means that it may be used for shallow water activities like swimming in a pool or in the ocean. However, Apple Watch Series 4 should not be used for scuba diving, water skiing, or other activities involving high velocity water or submersion below shallow depth. And so it sort of made it sound like I was saying that scuba diving, you know, below 50 meters was the activity you couldn't do, but scuba diving, you know, at lower depths or higher depths, lower depths, I guess, is okay. And as Ali pointed out, 50 meters is really deep diving. Like, that's deep scuba diving, and really only experienced scuba divers would go that low. And so I guess a little bit in the last episode, I made it sound like anything above 50 meters or not as deep as 50 meters would be okay for Apple Watch. And that's really not the case. As you can maybe tell from what I just read, Apple is just saying in general you shouldn't use your Apple Watch when scuba diving or water skiing. I would assume it also means jet skiing. Basically anything that could hard force water in there, which would include pressure water pressure at, deeper depths. So anything below what Apple calls shallow depth, although they don't really define that. But I would basically say, if you're on the surface in the ocean or in a pool, you're probably okay. But if you're going any much deeper than, your standard swimming pool, maybe 10 or 12 feet, then you probably shouldn't be wearing your Apple Watch. Neil also wrote in, and I'm kind of bringing this up because there was a lot of feedback on this water resistance thing. Neil also wrote in to remind folks that Apple Watches have different water resistance ratings depending upon which model you have. The newer models like the Series 3 and Series 4 are more water resistant than, say, the Series 1, which I think was not water resistant at all, although I think Tim Cook famously had said he showered with his Apple Watch 1 and it wasn't an issue. I personally wouldn't have done that with my, or Series 0, I guess it really was. But they've had different water resistance ratings. And as Neil points out, and I mentioned earlier too, Apple Watches are not quote unquote waterproof. They are water resistance. Neil also pointed out that water resistance can and actually does degrade over time. And I think it seems obvious, but once water resistance is lost or compromised, it doesn't come back, at least not without doing, some mechanical repairs or physical repairs to that device, right? You have to reseal it. But, the seals can break down over time and those sorts of things. And many factors can actually lead to the degradation of water resistance in a device, specifically chemicals, things like lotions, soaps, or shampoos. So I know that the listener that we heard feedback from on the last episode did mention that he showered with his Apple Watch, and also that when he was on vacation, he was putting, sunscreen and that sort of thing on, as you do. But, if you're getting those lotions or chemicals onto your Apple Watch, or you're getting soaps or shampoos onto your Apple Watch, those chemicals can actually start to break down and degrade some of that water resistance. So that may lead to some future problems. Another thing that Apple notes can be an issue is heat and humidity. So if you're in saunas or steam rooms, those sorts of things, they can also create an issue for water resistance and can degrade those seals and stuff like that. So those are all things to sort of be aware of when it comes to, and it's not just the Apple Watch, it would be anything that has a water resistance rating or is water resistance. These kind of environmental and physical chemical factors and stuff like that all come into play. Another thing to be aware of too, if you use an Apple Watch, if you do use an Apple Watch in water, and I swam with my Apple Watch both in the ocean and in the pool, and I've not had any issues or problems with water intrusion. I have a Series 2 Apple Watch, and it's really not been an issue. But if you do go swimming or do go in the water with your Apple Watch, you may want to make sure that you also enable its water lock mode or water lock feature. This is typically activated automatically if you start a swimming workout, or you can activate it manually from the control center on your Apple Watch by swiping up and then tapping on the little drop icon. What this will do is it will stop the screen from recognizing any touches being activated by the water, because the water can actually activate the screen, so it'll stop that from happening. And then once in the water lock mode, to unlock it, what you do is you roll up the digital crown. So twist the digital crown up until the speaker makes several loud audible beeps. And what that's doing is actually expelling the water from the speaker. So anything that got into the speaker will be pushed out. So pool water, salt water. And that is a good thing too, because eventually the pool chemicals or the salt from the water could potentially, corrode or erode the speaker as well. So you want to push that water out of there after you've gone for a swim or something like that. So just some things to think about when it comes to your Apple Watch and water resistance. And thanks to Ollie and Neil for sending in their comments on that. Something else that came up on the last episode of the MacCast was Apple's recall, voluntary recall, of some of the three-prong AC wall adapters in Hong Kong, Singapore, and the United Kingdom. These are the adapters that shipped with certain Mac models and iOS devices between 2003 and 2011, also ones that shipped as part of the Apple World Travel Adapter Kit. Well, I heard back after that episode from a few members of the MacCast community who ran into a little bit of trouble with that recall program. Some people who actually had these plug adapters wanted to get them replaced, and when they reached out and tried to contact Apple, they ran into a few issues. And I wanted to play a comment from one of them, Paul, who ran into this little hiccup.
Hi, Adam. It's Paul Adkins here from the UK. Regarding the recall policy of the three-pin plugs that you mentioned on the latest podcast, I have five of these old plugs, and they were, I think, left over when I've traded in my old iPads or Macs or something. I looked on the Apple recall website, and it said either contact Apple Store, an authorized retailer, or technical support. So I contacted technical support because I live quite away from an Apple store. And they said more or less that I would have to take it into an authorized retailer or an Apple store. So I contacted my nearest authorized retailer, and they said, yeah, well, we need a serial number to replace each plug. And I obviously don't have the serial numbers for any of those Macs now. But I am still using the plugs, so I contacted Apple Technical Support and said, you know, this was a difficult thing because, you know, these serial numbers are just not around. And they said, okay, they didn't want me to use these plugs and agreed to replace the five old style plugs with five new style ones, which was great. Well, the UPS guy turned up a few days later with three boxes. And in each box, there were five replacement plugs. So instead of giving me five replacement plugs, they'd sent 15. And I thought this was a bit odd, so I contacted Apple Support again. And they kept me on hold for what seemed like forever. And eventually, they came back and said, keep all 15 and keep the old ones too. There's a no returns policy. So apart from the five that I've swapped out for the old ones, 10 of them are just sitting in my loft. But it seems to me that Apple have kind of had a knee-jerk reaction with this and haven't really made their staff fully aware of the fact that there is a recall policy or how exactly you should go about it, because as I say, not everybody will have serial numbers, and Apple certainly don't want you to keep using these because they don't want to get sued if somebody gets an electric shock. But I just thought, I wonder what your views on this were. So as I say, in the meantime, I've got a shed load of Apple, new Apple 3-pin plugs. But there we go. A great show as usual, and I look forward to your comments. Thanks very much. Cheers.
Hey, Paul. My first comment, I think, really is that, and by the way, thank you for your voicemail. My first comment really is that I wish I could say you were the only one who ran into a problem with the serial numbers, but I received a few emails from other folks who met the same result, right? They called up to try to get their replacements, and Apple said, hey, give us your serial numbers for your products. And because these were from 2003 to 2010, I think it's pretty obvious, and a lot of people probably aren't going to have the serial numbers of those devices. They've long since replaced them, but they probably still have the plugs around, right? Because you could reuse those for several things. I know I have a bunch of old power plugs and power bricks and stuff like that, especially the adapters, which this really is, that I use for other devices and for other purposes. So I think You know, I think you're right. I think Apple probably internally wasn't really prepared, or maybe hadn't prepared its staff well enough for these scenarios. Also, I found there were some people who, when they didn't have the serial numbers, were having trouble getting actual replacements and kind of had to be escalated up the chain and stuff like that. I think Apple is likely just getting these things sorted out. It would have been nice if they had been maybe a little better prepared day one. Maybe they weren't ready for how quickly the news was going to probably roll out and get out to the public, and public would be coming in to look for their replacements. But for whatever it was, or whatever reason it is, I don't think it's a huge deal. I think they probably, by the time most people hear this, will have sorted things out, and hopefully the program will be running smoothly. If it's not, I'm sure those of you in the community will email me and let me know, or send me another audio comment. Let me know if you've run into issues as well, but hopefully not. And I guess if you do run into trouble and you're in the UK, maybe you could ring up Paul to get a replacement, because it sounds like he has a few extras. So there you go. And thanks, Paul, again, for your comment and just sharing your experience. If you've been listening to the show over the past few weeks, probably actually the past couple months, you probably know we've been talking a lot about the rumor of the new iPhone, the 2019 version of the iPhone, having a triple lens camera system. So the EyeSight camera being adding an additional lens, going from two lenses to three lenses, and that the camera bump is going to have what I've been calling the cracker bump, or more specifically, the Ritz cracker bump. Basically, it's going to have this big square bump instead of kind of the oval one that we have now, or I guess, has it technically an oval? I guess it's not really an oval. It's a rounded rectangle to a certain degree. I guess, I don't know what you call that shape now that I'm looking at it. A pill shape. That's probably the correct term for it, right? You got this pill-shaped bump. We're going to be going to this more square, what I've been calling the Ritz cracker bump. And Preston wrote in to point out a little flaw in my geometry. While Ritz cracker bump has a nice ring to it, as Preston pointed out in his email, it's geometrically inaccurate. And that is because the new bump, as I said, is square, but a Ritz cracker, the actual Ritz cracker, is actually round. Now, I'd been using Ritz cracker mostly not because I thought Ritz cracker was square, but because there's a camera shop here in the US, in some parts of the US, called Ritz Camera, and Ritz is a cracker, and the square bump looks like a cracker to me, not a Ritz cracker, but just a cracker in general. So I merged the two together, and in my mind, it just kind of rolled off the tongue. It was a nice play on words, Ritz camera bump, blah, blah, blah. I thought I was being clever. But obviously, I didn't think about the math in the situation, the geometry in the situation. And Preston was right to point it out that Ritz crackers are actually round. So a more correct cracker to reference might be something like, say, a saltine, which Preston recommended in his email to me, or possibly a Triscuit, or maybe even a Wheat Thin. But, you know, Triscuit camera bump or Wheat Thin camera bump, saltine camera bump, yeah, it just really doesn't quite have the same ring to it, though. So I get it. I understand it. We've made the correction. I think we're all in agreement that Ritz cracker is not the right shape. But I think I'm going to stick with that as my thing, because I started with it. I think it's funny and clever, and so I'm going to continue to use it. But hopefully that doesn't continue to upset you, Preston, and I apologize if it does. But thank you for sending in your email, because you're absolutely right. It is square and not round. I received an email from Dan this week, and he wrote in with a rhetorical question for me. He said in the subject of the email, quote, "What app do you use most?" And in the body of the email, he gave the pithy answer for himself of the update app. And he was basically making a commentary that apps, especially on iOS, I think, but even on the Mac, they're constantly asking for or requiring updates, or updates are being constantly pushed out. So you always have that little number on the App Store icon, right? This is like, hey, you've got 10 updates to do this today, or 5 tomorrow. And it seems like daily that we have app updates that we want to run. And Dan was getting a little bit annoyed by that. He's, you know, it's like, why are we getting so many app updates? It's really frustrating. I feel like I'm constantly the number one app that I'm running on my device is the App Store, the app update. And I totally get it. And it's a little bit funny and maybe a little bit painful for some people, Dan included. But I got the email and I thought about it and I thought, you know, yeah, that is somewhat annoying. But then I looked at more of the bright side of it, which is, isn't it a good thing that our apps are being consistently updated, that we're getting bug fixes and security patches and maybe some new features and enhancements and those sorts of things on a regular basis? And I kind of emailed that back to Dan, and I think he thought about it for a minute, emailed me back, and he was a little bit more pessimistic in his response and said, yeah, you could be right, Adam, but, you know, it also could be, quote, a sign of incompetent programming with poor QA, or perhaps they are slipping stuff past us as we blindly apply updates. And I get that side of it too. It's pretty funny, Dan. I think maybe you were trying to be a little bit ironic there. I hope you don't really feel that, you know, all these programmers have bad programming or incompetent QA, because I certainly don't think they do, at least not the apps that I buy and use. I try to avoid the ones that would be poor quality or poorly put together. But I do understand your point of view and sort of what you're thinking there, but I don't think that's the case most of the time. I really do think most of the time that Apple has created an ecosystem that makes it easy for an app developer to push out an update and not have to wait for a big major release to actually put in a bug fix or a patch or something like that. So I think app developers are more likely to update their apps more frequently. And if you have a lot of apps installed on your devices, and especially on iOS, a lot of us do, then yeah, you are going to get sort of notified about updates more frequently, and you are going to have a lot of updates to run. And so after this whole conversation happened with Dan back and forth on email, I got to thinking about this and I thought, you know, is there a way to kind of handle this for those people out there who maybe are a little bit annoyed by the number of app updates that they're constantly having to run? Is there some sort of solution, some sort of thing that we could do to maybe minimize that impact? And I thought of a few things off the top of my head that I'm going to talk about here. If you have some of your own thoughts or ideas or things that you do, shoot me some feedback. An email or an audio comment would be very welcome and add to this conversation. But first thing I thought of is, hey, you could just simply turn off app updates. If you go into your device, into the settings, into iTunes and App Store, and just toggle off the updates button, then you have to, you know, you'd have to go into manually update the apps in the App Store. You'd actually have to launch the App Store app, and then you would see all those updates available. So the updates don't go away. You're going to have a big list of them, but they're not going to automatically download or update. And I don't think it would then notify you or prompt you that you have updates ready to go. I can't remember if the badge on the icon, the little number on the icon, would show up or not. I think that still would be there as well, but you know, that might be a way to handle it. You could also turn off App Store notifications, so maybe you don't get notified that there are app updates there and, you know, ready and waiting. So you can go into Settings, Notifications, App Store, and set Allow Notifications to off for the App Store app. So that might be another way to handle it. And then I thought, well, maybe the problem really is what I was mentioning earlier, that we have so many apps installed on our devices and probably a lot of apps that we don't really use that are still getting updates pushed out to them. So that kind of artificially inflates the number of updates that you're seeing daily. So a possible way for dealing with that is maybe to just clean up the old apps that we have on our devices, like literally reduce the number of apps that you have installed down to just the few apps that you are actually using. And you can actually get a list of how often you use apps, or at least when the last time you launched an app on your iOS devices, to try and help you figure out, you know, what should I keep and what should I get rid of. So if you go into Settings, General, and then into iPhone storage or iPad storage, I would imagine if you have an iPad, you can go to that screen and you can wait for the list of apps to pop up. And when you see the list of apps on that screen, one of the bits of data that's on there is the last used value. So it will show you the last time that you used any one of those applications in that list. And so you can scroll down that list and look for any apps that you, one, haven't opened in a long time, or maybe you've never opened, because I had a few of those on my device. And I think it's since the last time you restored your device. So I did notice I had some apps that I would normally use, but I just hadn't launched or ran since sort of rebuilding my device. But I was able to go through that list and actually clear out probably about 30-35% of the apps that I actually had installed on my iPhone. A bunch of old stuff that I used back in the day, a lot of it games that I had sort of played through and was really done with. And I went through and just started removing those, started deleting them. And from that list, what you can do is you can tap on any one of the applications, and it'll give you a detail screen that will show you how much storage that app is using, how much space the app itself is using. So storage in terms of data for any files or things that might be associated with that app, and then just the app itself, how much storage is it taking up on your device. And then within that screen, you have two buttons or two options that you can click. One is called offload if you're running the latest version of iOS, and the other one is, of course, delete. If you tap delete, it is going to delete the app and all of its data. If you have an app that you're like, hey, I don't need this installed on my device, but I have data in it, I have information in it that I want to save, and maybe I want to open this app sometime in the future and still have access to that data, you can use the offload button. And what that will do is that will delete the app, but it will not delete the data for that app on your device. And that way, if you ever re-download the app, assuming it's still available in the App Store, and this is the big caveat you have to be careful with, is if you offload an application and then the developer removes that app from the App Store, you're obviously not going to be able to reinstall it. So just be careful with that. But it is an option, right, if you want to retain that data. And so just cleaning off the number of apps that you have on your device is naturally going to reduce the number of app updates you're actually going to have to go through. So those are some things that I thought about. Dan, I hope this list kind of helps you out and maybe gives you some ideas. If you're on a Mac and that's where you're getting a lot of your app updates, you can use techniques that are similar, especially just cleaning out any old Mac applications that you might have installed that you're no longer using. And I think that's a good way to go about it. And hopefully that helps get rid of some of these annoyances a little bit. But I really do think that overall, consistent and regular app updates are ultimately a good thing. And it really doesn't take too long to run these updates, at least for me. I might have a few dozen, sometimes 20 or 30 ready to go at any one time. But it's literally just going into the App Store and tapping update all and waiting a couple minutes for that to happen. I certainly understand that it can get a little naggy from time to time, and that might bother some people. So hopefully, again, just turning off some of these updates or doing some of these other things might help you out. And maybe some other members of the MacCast community have some even better ideas. This was just stuff, again, I thought of off the top of my head, but I'm sure there's some better recommendations out there. And if you have one of those, send it to me, maccast@gmail.com. And then finally in the show for this week, I have a thing of the moment for you, but this one comes from a listener. So this is a listener thing of the moment. I had asked for some recommendations from you for the stuff that you like. And for anybody who's new to the program, thing of the moment is just something that I either use or like or have related to my Mac or my iOS devices that I just share with you. So it could be an iPhone accessory. It could be a bit of software for my Mac. Doesn't really matter, but it's just the thing that I'm into at any given moment, or thing that I'm enjoying at any given moment related to my Apple devices and technology. And so I had asked for recommendations of the stuff that you like, because I thought, you know, it shouldn't just be the things that I'm into. We have a whole community of Mac and Apple fans out there, and you guys like really cool stuff too. And so I asked for your recommendations, and a few of you have written in. And this week, Mark wrote in with something that he really likes, which is a handy little print utility. It's called Print Selection. It is $4.99. You can get it on the App Store. That's $4.99 US, $4.99. It's from Chimp Studios, and you can get it directly from their website. I'll have a link to it in the show notes at maccast.com, or from the Mac App Store. So just search for Print Selection on the Mac App Store, and you will find it. But what this thing is it's a little menu bar application that allows you to take a selection of text or text and images. It can be rich text. Basically, make a selection of anything on your Mac, copy it, and then paste it into a window inside this menu bar app. And then it will just print out. It'll create a printout of just that content, that selection of content. And so you can do it that way. You can also access it by using the services menu. So make your selection, right click on that selection, go to the services menu, and you can say, hey, print with print selection, and it will print just that chunk of text. So it's an easy way to not print, say, an entire web page. You can also invoke the little menu bar paste area through a hotkey. And like I said, if you're reading a long web page article, maybe you just want the contents of the article. You don't want things like the banner ad or the sidebar ads or the footers, or you certainly don't want to print out all of the comments. And if you just do a standard print from inside Safari, you're going to get a lot of that junk. So this gives you the ability to just copy a chunk of text and then print out just that chunk of text. Another nice feature that Mark noted that it had was you can actually add, no pun intended, you can actually add a note to the selected content that you're printing out as well, and that will become part of your printout. And of course, you don't actually have to print to paper either. You can use this utility, and then when the print dialog comes up, do an export or a print to PDF, and then take that into another application, say OneNote or Evernote or any other kind of note management software or PDF management software that you might be using. Put it into your Dropbox, whatever. A great way to save little bits of text into little PDF files or documents as well. Of course, you can just print them, and the idea here is that you would be saving paper because you're not printing, you know, an entire chunk of a website with all kinds of extraneous stuff that you really don't need. You're just able to get the content itself. So that's a utility that Mark found really helpful and wanted to share with us. And Mark, thank you for doing that. I think it was a great pick and a great thing of the moment. But with that is going to do it for the MacCast for this week. Before I leave you, I do want to take a quick moment and thank a show sponsor, Smile, makers of Text Expander, PDF Pen, Disc Label, also Text Expander for iPhone and iPad, along with PDF Pen for iOS and PDF Pen Scan Plus. You can get more information and details on all of Smile's great applications by visiting smilesoftware.com/podcast. Bandwidth for the MacCast is provided by CacheFly. You can find them at cachefly.com. And all advertising on the MacCast is handled by Backbeat Media. They are at backbeatmedia.com. As always, I love hearing from you. If you have a comment, a question, something you'd like to hear covered on a future episode of the MacCast, you can send your emails and audio comments to maccast@gmail.com. You can also call in on the listener hotline and leave a voicemail. That phone number, 281-622-4269, 281-MAC-IM-9. And if you need show notes, links to anything that I talked about on this or any other episode of the MacCast, you can find those on the website. That's at maccast.com. And finally, if you want to follow me on social media, you'll find me on Twitter, twitter.com/MacCast, or you can check out the MacCast Facebook page over at facebook.com/TheMacCast. But that will do it for now. Until next time, I will talk to you all again real soon.